Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bombshell revelations in the New York Times into the background of Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, who was the target of a recent FBI raid. An expert on money laundering and offshore banking, James Henry, the author of Blood Bankers and co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service DCReport.org, joins us. He joins us to discuss how Cohen came to Trump's attention because he was buying condos in Trump Tower for Russian and Ukrainian gangsters, and what role Cohen played after Trump was blackballed by U.S. banks after taking them down when the Trump Organization moved from debt to cash. Given Cohen's mob ties revealed by the New York Times that go back to his favorite uncle Morty, who was a doctor for the Lucchese crime family and owner of a catering hall frequented by mobsters, then deeper connections with Cohen's Ukrainian father-in-law, who runs a catering hall frequented by Ukrainian and Russian mobsters, little wonder that Cohen was on the FBI's radar. And we will speculate how much the extent of evidence seized by the FBI will implicate Trump in ties to organized crime. Then we'll get an assessment of whether the upcoming Kim Trump Jong-un summit and the recent meetings between the leaders of North and South Korea could bring an end to the Korean War and peace on the Korean Peninsula and even a reunification of the two Koreas. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, joins us to discuss the competing centers of power in the Trump administration over the direction of U.S. foreign policy, with the Koch brothers-backed Mike Pompeo, who laid the groundwork for the summit with Kim, representing a more libertarian realpolitik approach, competing with the neoconservative wing championed by the new national security advisor, John Bolton, who is itching to go to war with Iran. Then finally, we'll look into Tuesday's important primary races in the important swing state, Ohio, and speak with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. Because the Ohio governorship is key to the Democrats' chance to remake the electoral map in the 2020 census, which is now in doubt. He joins us to discuss the weird, wacky, and bitter battle for the governorship in Ohio, which the Democrats were hoping to pick up with Richard Cordray, who is now being challenged by Dennis Kucinich, who, ironically, was gerrymandered out of office. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he is the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, DCReport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And how much do you think this New York Times revelation about the background of Michael Cohen and his family ties, both going back with Uncle Morty, who was the doctor for the Lucchese crime family, and then his father-in-law, who apparently brought in Russian and Ukrainian gangsters into his catering hall, and in turn Cohen brought them into Trump Tower, where they bought a bunch of condos, and that got Trump's attention, according to New York Times, and that's why Cohen became his lawyer. So, how much is this? I mean, there's always been rumors about Trump having ties to organized crime, because the assumption is if you're in New York real estate, it's pretty hard not to eventually come in touch with organized crime.
Well, I think this is the latest chapter and kind of a longer and longer set of evidentiary submissions that we have about the basic kind of lengthy dubious associations that Trump has. This has become a kind of Roach Motel. Cohen is a very peculiar guy from the standpoint of having him as your personal lawyer. Donald Trump could obviously have afforded almost anyone as a lawyer, but he chose this fellow as basically a kind of a fixer and had the office right next door to him in the Trump Tower from 2007 on. As the Times article, I think, lays out in glorious detail, And it's just hard to make this stuff up. I mean, he has uncles who are, you know, doctoring to the Lucchese crime family, you know, had gas pipe Casso as this guy whose house the fellow owned. Father-in-law who, you know, the first thing that happens after he comes to the United States is that he's tagged for, you know, laundering $5.5 million. You know, it's just the story goes on and on. But I think what this underscores, if we step back from it, is first of all, you know, these are all kind of pre-Putin relationships that date back to the 1970s, 1980s, and certainly the 1990s. And the emphasis here is not on the sort of collusion 2016 election story, but on the fundamental fact that Donald Trump had an awful lot of engagement with people who had, you know, sort of a lot of criminal activity in their backgrounds. You know, Cohen has not been convicted of anything, and I think that's another key theme here is that despite all of this smoke pouring out of the basement, we really have a kind of a dramatic long-term failure of New York law enforcement to come to grips with all this stuff. We already saw that in the case of Felix Sater, who cut a very favorable plea deal that, you know, with the in the Eastern District of New York that allowed him to go on and help Trump finance the Trump Soho with dubious money. Here we have Michael Cohen having an equally set of, you know, questionable relationships and unexplained transactions like these three real estate cash purchases in 2003. For $32 million. I mean, that just has all the earmarks of money laundering. And yet, you know, this guy has never done jail time. He's never been indicted, let alone convicted of anything. And you know, in fact, he's the personal attorney of the United States president. So I think that's another theme here. We really need to go back to basics and understand why it was, despite all of these, you know, various activities spanning decades, that, you know, law enforcement here in New York just never managed to bring these people to justice.
Well, you know, Rudy Giuliani, who's had a bad week, who's Trump hired as his new lawyer and who's made a lot of misstatements, and Trump apparently had to come to the rescue and say that maybe Rudy will get his facts straight at some point. But, for example, if you go back to, remember Donovan, Ray Donovan, who Reagan was going to have as his labor secretary? Well, yeah. You know, the FBI had Ray Donovan on tape talking to a New York crime boss. And that was squelched by the United States attorney in the Southern District at the time, one Rudolph Giuliani. So Giuliani's always, you know, had one foot in the law and one foot in organized crime.
Well, I think so. You know, they say that he was tough on the mob. The question is which mob? And here we have the Russian mob basically moving into New York in a big way in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union. All the money that Trump is able to raise, you know, he couldn't have raised from U.S. banks because he has between four and six bankruptcies in the 1990s. Cost the banks about $11 billion in write-offs. So he couldn't borrow from anybody. He had to rely on dirty money and flight capital from, you know, former Soviet Union GARCs. And Giuliani, by the way, is going to have a very bad week this week. You know, the Dutch public television, Zembla, is coming up with yet another installment of their outstanding series of documentaries, and this is going to highlight his role in, you know, his law firm Bracewell set up companies so that Felix Sater could launder money from Kazakhstan into the Trump Soho. You know, this was going on as recent as 2014. Giuliani's law firm was involved in setting up those companies. And Giuliani was also found to be trying to raise money for his Kazakhstan, for his 2008 presidential campaign in Kazakhstan. You know, and I've identified another set of relationships that he has with very peculiar people from the Ukraine. that we're about to write that story. So, you know, there's just Trump seems to keep surrounding himself with lawyers who have their own sort of shady associations, and I don't think Giuliani's reputation back in the 1980s, is going to, may not survive this latest round of revelations.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. So the article, of course, on Michael Cohen, who's, again, he's both his home, his office, and his hotel room was raided by the FBI in a very, very extensive raid, started apparently from a referral by the special prosecutor Robert Mueller to the Southern District of New York, and this was, of course, the district, the U.S. attorney that Donald Trump fired pre-Pereira, tried to put in his own person, but nevertheless, they were able to do this extensive raid. They had what's called a clean team to go in there and make sure that there was no conflict of interest seized in terms of attorney-client privilege, and that's all now before a special master. So there's apparently a ton of evidence. So my assumption...
Well, I was... it's interesting. Cohen lives out in the Hamptons, where I reside, and, you know, I have a friend at one of the high-end department stores where he happened to be that afternoon when he found out the news, and she heard him on the telephone saying, "Don't worry, I'm not going to talk."
No, who was he talking to, do you think?
No idea.
Good Lord.
But he was shell-shocked by that raid. You know, this is coming down to be the critical issue in the Mueller investigation. I mean, he's had a long time now to pore over the evidence of actual collusion between Putin and the campaign and the evidence for obstruction. And we kind of know, you know, the basics there. Just not clear even now that those cases will stick. But in this area of financial crimes, this is the area that really makes Trump nervous, I think. And he's kind of trying to draw a bright line around it. He was, Friday before the NRA talking about how the judge in Virginia had ruled in his, or sort of was sort of made remarks from the bench that were consistent with his point of view, which is that all of this criminal stuff is off limits. And, Trump has been very sensitive about the Manafort prosecution, which is based on money laundering and tax dodging. And in this case of Cohen, he's going to be equally, sort of even more sensitive, because potentially the guy knows, a lot of more about this kind of chicanery. And that's going to come out, I think, to be a defining issue in the Mueller investigation. Will he be able to go into these sort of reasonably well-documented, at least there's an enormous amount of evidence, this long-term kind of involvement with dubious critters. I think that's, something that, the jury is out about how that will turn out, but I think, if he's allowed to investigate those crimes, we'll find out. There will be just many more stories like the one that just appeared in the Times today.
Well, but the Times paints a picture of the ultimate bottom feeder in Michael Cohen. He starts out as a personal injury attorney, or an ambulance chaser. First of all, he gets his law degree from the Thomas M. Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan, which is considered the worst law school in America. Then he's a bottom feeding, personal injury attorney. And then he marries the Ukrainian woman whose father-in-law then sets him up in business. And this, you mentioned the $32 million cash property deals.
And they also happen to have those guys, the father-in-law and Cohen, have $26 million of loans outstanding to some Ukrainian fellow, and without much collateral, according to the story.
But they actually made some money apparently by managing 260 cabs with their medallions. The drivers, of course, had to pay them $100 per shift, and millions apparently flowed in. And Cohen, of course, began carrying a licensed pistol in an ankle holster. I don't know whether that's...
I'm wondering, you know, Ian, whether many Americans won't look at this as a great American success story. I mean, the guy shows up, you know, his father-in-law shows up from Ukraine in 1975. I mean, these guys basically have put it together, you know, elbowing their way through the laws and regulations in New York, and have come up to be, you know, worth tens of millions of dollars. And from the standpoint, I'm not apologizing for it, but I think from there's a certain element of this time story which has a sort of you know, kind of white shoe mentality. These people are, you know, they're sort of from the gutter. They're not worthy. I would love to see some actual evidence of hardcore crimes come out of the Times investigation about these guys. But right now, you know, all we have in this Times report is an awful lot of smoke, and we're still going to wait for Mueller to sort of tie up, you know, tie the bow around it and actually get some indictments here. That's where it gets real.
Right, but has any American president in history had these kind of sleazy ties? I mean, the first guy that Mueller sentenced is this Dutch lawyer whose father-in-law is German Kahn, who's a Russian oligarch who ripped off BP. And when the BP executive met at his huge, you know, estate in Russia, he was scared to death because of all the criminals around, and apparently German Kahn told the BP guy who was basically stealing from that his whole outlook on life was shaped by the Godfather movies.
No, I mean, I quite agree. I mean, Cervantes says, you know, you are who you walk with, and there's no question that Trump has had, at the very least, lots of associations that are, you know, with dubious people. I'm just saying that, you know, there is a kind of a need to get on with making actual criminal cases here, and I think that's where we're, you know, kind of, you know, we're still waiting for Godot. One thing the Times actually kind of, I think, got wrong in the story, I wanted to highlight this. This is the role of Felix Sater in the original story. I mean, according to Sater, who is the fellow that helped Trump finance the Trump Soho with lots of dubious money, including money from old kleptocrats, Sater had known Cohen way back in the 1980s. They were childhood friends, and you know, the Times makes it sound as if Sater, you know, had no role in introducing Trump to Cohen. I think, you know, we really need to take a closer look at that long-term relationship between Felix Sater, whose father was also in the Russian mafia, and Cohen and Trump. I think it goes back to the 90s at least.
Well, but both Sater and Cohen, they talk like mafias, you know, dems and does. You know, I mean, I think that's why Cohen didn't play a prominent role in Trump, like Scaramucci and now.
Well, he's, you know, from that standpoint, he's exactly the kind of guy you'd like to have as your fixer. I mean, he's perfect. You know, he's not going to take off to go to a, you know, Wall Street law firm anytime soon. And he probably found the perfect client. You know, he only had three clients, and Trump appears to have been the most important. So he ended up doing things like fixing deals with, you know, sort of porn stars. The whole thing is, you know, is contemptible from the standpoint of what Americans ought to be able to expect of the president. But, you know, whether any of this adds up to impeachment or to criminality is going to be, you know, that's what we've got to determine, hopefully, in the next 6 months.
So, in other words, people that have been involved whose families are involved in a life of crime, and all their associates are known criminals, you still have to make a case. I mean, what?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, from that standpoint, I mean, the elite in America has long been, you know, sort of casting aspersions on the Italians and the immigrant communities who come here and form criminal gangs. And I mean, it's sort of a long-time prejudice in a way. At the end of the day, it strikes me that the fact that New York law enforcement has basically failed to make any cases against a lot of these guys, or indeed has cut them when they did have cases, they cut them generous plea bargains, as in the case of Sater, you know, that enabled them to go on and be kind of, you know, financial Whitey Bulgers and pursue lots of...
Well, but that had something to do with the intelligence people, because he was also an FBI and CIA asset, Sater. So,
well, that's what he says. I want to see the CIA sources come out and say that. None of that, by the way, is in his 1994 plea agreement, which is still under seal, but we've had reports of what's in it. Mm-hmm. You know, you would think that if he'd been a big his 2004 plea agreement, you think it would have been mentioned that he was a CIA or intelligence operative in the plea deal. Pre-sentencing report, if that were the true, but it's not.
Well, just in closing, Trump obviously is a wannabe celebrity, and that's his Achilles heel. He really wants to be loved and accepted by Hollywood, and the best he can come up with is Scott Baio and now that ridiculous guy that's married to the Kardashian. Kanye West is the best he can do. But not only is he a wannabe celebrity, he's also a wannabe billionaire. It's very doubtful that he's been a billionaire. He may still not even be a billionaire, although he's making a ton of money out of the presidency.
His brand has taken a big hit from this, and I think...
That's true. But my point is that is it worse than... in a sense that he's tied to organized crime. Is he a wannabe gangster? Is that the psychology of this guy? He likes hanging out with mobsters. He likes all that sort of macho stuff. You know, you recall Michael Cohen the other day when they found pictures of him. He was hanging out with a bunch of mobsters smoking cigars. So is that...
Yeah, you know, he's the president of the United States. I mean, it's not hard to make it look like... He's never been convicted of anything. From that standpoint, that's the definition of a successful criminal in my book, as someone who gets away with it. So he has had, from one standpoint, he may not be nearly as wealthy as he has claimed to be. That's probably the case. But it's kind of beside the point. He's succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. He never expected to, coming out of Brooklyn, Queens, to become president of the United States. So I think we should give him some credit for this and stop calling him stupid.
Of course.
He has what Keynes used to call animal spirits, and he surrounded himself with people like Cohen, and Sater, and lots of unsavory people. He's far closer to being a mobster than he is a mole. And I think, the real issue is, are the American people really okay with this?
Right. Well, he's going up in the polls, so maybe they are. It's shocking, isn't it?
But shocking and disturbing.
I thank you for joining us, James Henry.
Great. Good to be with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investor journalist. He's written extensively about global banking, debt crisis, and tax havens. He's the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company and the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into whether there is going to the Korean War is going to end, whether there'll be peace on the Korean Peninsula, and even a reunification of the two Koreas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his latest novel is Bear, about the Great Bear Rainforest and eco-terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And even though it appears that this summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un seems to be in the works, there's been a couple of wrinkles. The newly appointed lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, said that the North Koreans were about to release the three American hostages, and suddenly that didn't happen. He said it was going to happen a couple of days ago, and it didn't happen. And then just today, the North Koreans, through their official spokesman, said the U.S. is deliberately provoking the DPRK at a time when the situation on the Korean Peninsula is moving towards peace and reconciliation. The spokesman warned the U.S. not to interpret Pyongyang's willingness to talk as a sign of weakness, saying that pressure and military threats won't work, and that because the U.S. is saying that pressure won't be eased until North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons completely. So we know that the South Korean leader will be at the White House on May the 22nd. From my understanding, that's where the real action is between the two Korean leaders, although obviously, this summit's very important. So let's start with that. How do you connect those two issues, the inter-Korean summit and the American-North Korean summit?
Well, there's no question that ultimately the issue at hand, the long-term issue at hand, is the relationship between the two Koreas and perhaps ultimately one day united Korea. So I think the conjunction of happening to have the present leader, the present president of South Korea, who is very keen and has long been interested in this process, and Kim Jong-un, who seems suddenly remarkably attuned to this, that is vital. On the other hand, as you just suggested earlier, Ian, the United States holds the ultimate spoiling card. If it doesn't want this to happen, I don't even know whether it needs to say to the South Koreans that, no, we're not going to go there. It could be that simply incidents in the background, I don't even know what they are, military, they may be covert, whatever else, could certainly throw a monkey wrench into the works and the entire thing. So, yeah, it's great that North and South Korea are talking and the atmospherics are good, but the U.S., for its own reasons, might decide in the end to scotch it.
Well, I don't think that decision would come from Trump, though. That's an extraordinary, scary prospect, because it seems to me that Trump desperately wants a win. He gets nothing but, as he said himself yesterday at a rally in Ohio, he gets nothing but bad press, even though his poll numbers are going up. And he's mired in deeply into scandal. It seems to be absolutely unyielding. He wants a win. I'm not sure that he cares about the details. He'll just sign whatever makes him look good. That seems to be who this man is. So would that mean that the battle behind the scenes between the neoconservatives, who are represented by John Bolton, who was basically pushed into there, or you know, the person pushing him for that job was Sheldon Adelson. So he's in tight with the neoconservatives. And then on the other side, Pompeo, who seems to be leading this initiative and who had the secret talks with Kim Jong-un, Pompeo is more of a protege of the Koch brothers. So he, I think, has a more libertarian, more realpolitik kind of attitude. So do you see that configuration in U.S. foreign policy, that the big donors behind this administration are pulling the strings?
Well, money always pulls strings in any administration and at every single level of Congress. It was Will Rogers who said that the United States has the best Congress that money can buy. I I think it's very interesting what the correlation of forces are. Bolton, I guess, would certainly qualify as a neoconservative, and that Pompeo has leanings towards the Koch brothers I find quite fascinating, because that could take the country in a very different foreign policy direction. I don't have much use for the Koch brothers at all on anything domestic, but I am encouraged that I think some of their libertarian thinking seems to be rather sensible. The other interesting aspect of this, though, Ian, is that traditionally, of course, the neoconservatives have been tied in very closely with Israel. That is their number one love, their number one goal. And anything touching the Middle East, obviously, it fully draws in the Israeli factor. I wonder how strong that is when we get over to the Far East. I don't know whether the Israelis as such have a dog in this fight in North Korea. Certainly, I think the Israelis and Netanyahu and that whole powerful conservative group would prefer a strong American imperial global presence, because they see them, Israel sees itself as tied to that and riding on the back of that. But, you know, whether they would move heaven and earth to try to stop it, or could stop Trump if he was really determined to do it, is not quite the same question. And the Pentagon itself, I think clearly the Pentagon would, speaking of it generically, would probably prefer the maintenance of, strongly prefer the maintenance of bases in South Korea and a major presence in East Asia. But, you know, how far are they willing to intervene to block it? God knows they can do it easily.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades, and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his latest novel is Bear, about the Great Bear Rainforest and eco-terrorism. So I think that may be actually the division here, that the neocons have captured Middle East policy, at least vis-a-vis Iran, because it looks like Trump will pull out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal on May the 12th. And that's certainly something that Netanyahu's been pushing. Netanyahu's entree into the White House has not just Sheldon Adelson, it's also been Jared Kushner. The families are very close. He seems to have, his star seems to have dimmed a little bit. So maybe that is what's going on, that this is a separate theater and they don't have a dog in this fight. But what's your sense, though, of China's role? Because Kim Jong-un did make that secret trip to China, and it feels like he was setting the table with the Chinese before proceeding to set the table with the South Koreans. And then, of course, in the interim, there were the secret meetings in Pyongyang with Mike Pompeo.
Yes, well, I think China's number one consideration in the entire region, or you might even say in the globe, is to prevent the U.S. from dominating the entire global agenda, either economically or geopolitically or otherwise. It doesn't mean defeat the U.S. or whatever, but it certainly means that they will not any longer accept a sole single superpower that the United States has prided itself on since the fall of the Soviet Union. I think that aspiration is now seriously weakened. But Russia also, who is a player in this, because Russia borders on North Korea and has been involved in North Korean politics for a long time, since really the end of World War II. So both of these two states, at the very least, have their number one goal is to make sure that the United States does not absolutely call all the shots. So if the U.S. pulls out of South Korea and no longer maintains that base, that is a net plus, I would argue, for both Russia and China in that area. On the other hand, on a more subtle level, it does present China with some slightly new problems, a more perhaps resolute, independent-minded South Korea. It's already somewhat in that area, but it would become even more so. United Korea would be a much stronger force on China's and Russia's border, if that should come to be. But I think both of those are preferable for China to deal with than dealing with American military power right on its doorstep, contestation of the whole South China Sea and the Taiwan issue.
Well, I would assume then that we know that the Chinese don't want a collapse in North Korea. They don't want the South Koreans and the Americans on the Yalu River again. So that is why they've been supporting the North. But also, I would assume that the Chinese are not happy with Kim Jong-un's nuclear program because that's brought in more U.S. military assets. And the THAAD system, which the Chinese are extremely upset about, and they, in fact, cut off their trade relations with South Korea over the U.S. deployment of the THAAD missile intercepting system in South Korea.
Well, that's exactly right. The last thing China wants is more American power and more American weapons in South Korea, which will have long-term implications for China-Japan policy, China-Taiwan policy, and the whole South China Sea. So, yeah, but I still say I think a removal of the immediate presence of American military there has to be the number one presence. And I'm impressed that how quickly both Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping in China seem to have made up for the past serious tensions. This is quite astonishing. I mean, I think most of observers in the West had assumed that Kim Jong-un was something of a fool and isolated and out of touch with reality and everything else. But I think he's shown himself extremely adroit and knowledgeable, and that trip to China was quite a stunning turnaround to bring the two into a much closer alliance in facing or supporting Kim in his talks with Trump and the U.S.
Well, of course, relations were pretty frosty because, after all, Kim, when he first came in, Kim Jong-un, the first thing he did was to kill his uncle, who was the liaison to Beijing, and then he killed his older half-brother using a binary form of nerve gas, a very advanced nerve gas at an airport in Malaysia, and his older half-brother was under the protection of the Chinese at the time. So clearly, things got off to a frosty start. So what's changed here is something obviously happened between the famous photo op of Mike Pence going to the Olympics in Winter Olympics in South Korea, and
yeah,
sort of sitting in front of Kim's sister, you know, frozen like a sphinx, and then suddenly that went nowhere, and then suddenly the South Korean intelligence people, the National Security Advisor and the head of South Korean intelligence, show up in Pyongyang, and then they show up in the executive office building, and then somehow they're called into the White House, and they tell Trump that they had a very good meeting with Kim Jong-un, and without hesitation, Trump agreed to a meeting. And gave nothing up in the traditional sense. And so this is not normal, is it, the way deals are made, that you always get
something?
No,
it isn't. On the other hand, I think just because Trump is impulsive doesn't always mean that it has to be wrong. In this case, and who knows what Trump's immediate impulses were. Many people refer to smelling a Nobel Prize down the road or something. I think that's entirely possible, but there are worse reasons for having peace talks and smelling a Nobel Prize. I mean, one could alternatively go to war. So I wouldn't want to predict where Trump is going, but he continues to be unpredictable. And as I say, I think he's not under the immediate pressure and guidance of the pro-Israeli neocon movement and maybe sensed a way out of this. It's interesting that Trump, for all his incredibly bellicose language, so far has avoided essentially large numbers of casualties around the world in American military actions. I mean, George Bush, at the same time in his career, was working his way up towards killing a million people. Trump hasn't even begun to do anything. It doesn't mean he might not, but he has not so far. So this may be slightly different impulse at work here. Who knows what the real Trump is, but I think it isn't necessarily bad that Trump felt that this was a positive thing to pursue rather than going through the very tiresome and medieval mechanisms sometimes that the American foreign policy establishment represents.
Well, the point that you're making, that George W. Bush is responsible for the death of a million or perhaps more, for him, Cheney, and Rumsfeld and Rice's intervention in Iraq, the wounds of which...
And Afghanistan,
the wounds of which still continue to this day. That's well taken. Of course, a lot of people now are saying that George W. Bush looks good in a nostalgic way because people are alarmed at Trump and that by default, Bush looks good. But on the metric that you just mentioned, the fact that Trump has not been responsible for wholesale deaths abroad as opposed to George W. Bush is something, I think, to think about.
Yes, in the end, I mean, I'm afraid if you sit in the West, these deaths are all rather abstract in the Middle East, but they are very real, and they have destroyed country after country in the region, which, as you know, opens the door to chaos and certainly to terrorism, which is a powerful legacy of all of those wars and far from over yet. So in that sense, I think maybe a distraction in a more positive direction in South Korea, in Korea's, would be welcome. But the U.S. has to decide whether it is willing to give up its a significant piece of territory in its military presence in East Asia.
I recall when George W. Bush was in Iraq meeting at a press conference with Nouri, the Iraqi leader, that an Iraqi journalist threw a shoe at George W. Bush and he ducked. But what the journalist said when he threw the shoe was, "You dog, you have destroyed my country and killed my people." That journalist is now running for parliament in Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I don't think we have a clue here as to what the emotions are seething between the, beneath the surface in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter, or in Somalia or in Yemen or many of these other places where truly poisonous legacies are continuing. So maybe that's one reason why some of us at least are clinging on, maybe naively, who knows, to feel a sense that the dynamic in East Asia is a bit different. The dealing with China is obviously a very different and complex thing. And the U.S. has a lot to balance off with in its calculus about presence in Korea, presence, relations with Taiwan, and our immensely important relations with China.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his newest novel is Bear, about the great bear rainforest and eco-terrorism. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Tuesday's important primary races in the important swing state of Ohio. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His latest book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I sure hope that Donald Trump is doing your sales of your book a lot of good, Robert, because at every opportunity he talks about his glorious Electoral College victory.
Well, I'm actually writing a sequel to the book, and he figures prominently in that sequel. So, yeah, there's a lot on representation issues there. You're right, Donald Trump can't quit the Electoral College. He keeps talking about it, but I'm not exactly sure he knows how it really works.
Well, let's turn to your state of Ohio and this critical governor's race. The reason it's critical is that it's key to the Democrats' chance of remaking the electoral map in 2020 in this important swing state. I find it deeply ironic that the Democratic pick, Richard Cordray, the former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and a protege of Senator Elizabeth Warren's, he's being challenged by Dennis Kucinich, who ironically was gerrymandered out of office by the Republicans. And the whole point is that if you get a Democratic governor in there and a legislature, then you can reverse the gerrymandering in the state. So do you see that as a bit ironic that the spoiler in this race, Dennis Kucinich, is the one who got done in by gerrymandering?
Well, there's even another layer to that, and that's issue one in the state of Ohio, which actually will look to curb gerrymandering and create a bipartisan system to draw congressional districts. So, and it's showing widespread support. So gerrymandering in the state of Ohio may be on the decline if issue one passes. So, yeah, there's a lot of layers to this particular election here during the primary.
And on both sides, the Democratic side and the Republican side, it's been bitter, weird, wacky,
yeah,
venomous, deeply dishonest, particularly on the Republican side. The race between the Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor has gotten quite personal. So let's start with that one. Are they going to sort of dirty each other up to the point where they both will lose?
Yeah, I think that they're both trying to out-Trump one another and certainly embracing President Trump, although DeWine and Taylor, neither one of them endorsed Trump during the 2016 election. Taylor has taken some criticism in particular because John Kasich, her boss, her running mate, when she ascended to office, really has been at the top of the never-Trump train, and she pretty much sat silent back in 2016, and now she is really trying to embrace much of Donald Trump's populism. And, you know, she's accused Mike DeWine, who's a pretty establishment politician, but pretty conservative nonetheless, of being tied to Hillary Clinton, which really is not the case here. And, of course, Republicans have been, if they want a boogeyman, Hillary Clinton has been it. And to tie DeWine to Clinton, those will be things that will certainly hurt Republican turnout in a general election, you know, if that's something that they're looking at. And DeWine is also going after Taylor as well as kind of being, you know, pretty fake in the way that she has conducted herself, kind of saying one thing, kind of the straight political thing, saying one thing and doing another. So, yeah, it's been a pretty nasty race. DeWine seems to be on top, but there's still a lot of people that are unsure on the Republican side. In fact, there's 25% in a recent Ohio poll that say that they're not sure who they're going to vote for on the Republican side. Taylor is at 25% herself, and DeWine appears to be in the lead there with a 52% favorable rating from Republicans. So we shall see, but you're right. These things do have a way to play themselves out in the general election as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His latest book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. Well, on the Democratic side, one of the stranger twists is that a big GOP donor paid for ads to attack the Democrat Richard Cordray for being too soft on gun control, even though Kucinich is playing up the idea that he got an F from the NRA rating and Cordray got an A. But nevertheless, you got the Republicans making ads attacking the Democrat, Richard Cordray, that are going to help elect Kucinich in the primary. So clearly, at least from that example, the Republicans want to run against Kucinich, not against Cordray.
Yeah, I think Kucinich is the firebrand, and he always has been a firebrand. And so Cordray seems to be the more, for lack of a better term, the more serious politician, the one that I think that Republicans would be a little bit more afraid of. Now, what's interesting about that GOP-led ad for the Democrats is that about a million more Republicans registered back in 2016 in the primaries, and people are wanting to see, what does that mean? Was that really a surge for Donald Trump back in 2016? He fared surprisingly well in Ohio. He actually did much better in Ohio than he did across the country. He had 51% of the vote, 46% across the country. So Ohio really did swing big for Trump. And that's part of the issue here, is that some people look that they wanted to, you know, the Democrat race back in 2016 was pretty much finished. And so there were a lot of, I think, Democrats switching over to vote for John Kasich to do the same kind of thing, to kind of keep the Republican race going. So, you know, Democrats kind of did it in 2016, and now we're seeing some Republicans doing that here in 2018. So, yeah, every trick in the book is being played in this primary. You know, Ohio is a crown jewel in presidential politics, and it's been a pretty purple state, although Republicans have dominated state politics for several generations now. So Cordray seems to be the one to beat for him. You know, he's outpolling Kucinich 31% to 15%. And the other Democrats that are in a race on the Democrat side actually are coming from the Cleveland area and Youngstown area, kind of Trump country Youngstown area. And so that may take even more votes away from Kucinich. So if I were a betting person, and by the way, another 41% of Democrat voters say that they're unsure. So there's, again, a lot of uncertainty. But if I were a betting person, I'd say Rich Cordray is probably going to get the nod here on Tuesday.
Well, of course, Kucinich is the Huffington Post and other outlets have written a number of negative stories about him. Apparently, in his campaign filings, a $20,000 payment by a pro-Assad group showed up, and he spoke at a London peace conference, which was largely stacked and organized by pro-Assad, and at which Assad's government spokespeople also talked. And frankly, it's just inescapably true that Assad is probably the worst mass murderer, certainly of this century. You have to go back to Pol Pot, probably, to have somebody that is as blood-stained and evil, and it is hard to understand what Kucinich is up to. And, of course, in Kucinich, he tweeted out praise for Trump's inaugural address, but then he later deleted that tweet. And he was also a commentator on Fox News. And frankly, if you're a liberal commentator on Fox News, you're being used by Fox and by Rupert Murdoch. You're deliberately put on there to make liberals look stupid and weak and pathetic and ridiculous. That's your job. So to that extent, Kucinich has been helping Fox and the Republicans. And he also spoke at the American Conservative Union's CPAC convention. So how's all of... I mean, I could go on this more stuff. Kucinich's ties to the Russian propaganda outlet RT as well. So what happened to Kucinich? Did he? Because he was a very, very highly regarded progressive when he was in Congress, a real champion. So what happened to him since he got forced out of office by Republican gerrymandering that made him run against Marcy Kaptur?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think all the points that you make are certainly in the background, and that might be why we see so much soft support for Kucinich, even though he's kind of seen, you know, as that Bernie Sanders firebrand in this particular contest, is that he does have a lot of baggage, and a lot of baggage that he didn't quite have 10 years ago. And so it's interesting, as bad as Assad's been, probably him praising Donald Trump is probably more of a sin amongst Democrats than anything. And so saying that, you know, Trump's inaugural address was a fantastic, was a great address, you know, a lot of Democrats looked at that address and they just said, you know, they're shaking their heads going, you know, what happened to my country, right? And so Kucinich definitely lost a lot of points there. And the other side of that is that Cordray has really been playing up his ties to Barack Obama. And Obama remains very popular. So, as I mentioned, Hillary Clinton is kind of like the boogeyman. You know, for Democrats, Obama is still seen with a very positive view. And had they had the opportunity, and frankly, had many Americans had the opportunity to vote for Obama for a third term, given the Clinton and Trump candidacies, we could have seen perhaps an Obama third term. So Cordray has that working for him, and he's showing a lot of clips of himself with Barack Obama. So kind of casting that relative to Dennis Kucinich praising Trump, Dennis Kucinich giving a speech that seems a bit misplaced, and only coming up when FEC filings come up and then saying, well, I'll give back the money. That doesn't seem like the people's person. So Kucinich definitely has a pretty difficult road to go here in order to win this nomination.
And is Elizabeth Warren helping Cordray?
I she doesn't hurt. You know, I think that she has some of the same bona fides that that Bernie Sanders has. You know, and having that tie there, and frankly, the job of the Consumer Protection Bureau. You know, kind of being the champion for the little guy, the little gal, the person kind of looking out for people over corporations, and then seeing what the Trump administration has actually done to that office with Mick Mulvaney, basically saying let's try and do nothing, let's get rid of this office, is also kind of seen as a, you know, pretty strong credential for Cordray to have in his back pocket as well. So, you know, it's kind of where words meet action, and Cordray's been there on that front.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Robert Alexander, and filling us in on this. As I say, Tuesday's important race, both in Ohio, Indiana, and in West Virginia. We didn't even touch on that, because a really bad, horrible guy is running as a Republican for the Senate in West Virginia, who's put out the most racist ads against Mitch McConnell, talking about McConnell's China family. Good Lord, you wouldn't think anybody would even use the English in that way. So we'll all stay tuned on Tuesday, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and happy Sunday to you.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His latest book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marston. I'd like to thank producer Joshua Shear. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.